disclaimer.
You must not rely on information on our website or broadcast it as an alternative to medical advice from your doctor or other professional healthcare provider. If you have any specific questions about any medical matter, you should consult your doctor or other professional healthcare provider. If you think you may be suffering from any medical condition, you should seek immediate medical attention. You should never delay seeking medical advice, disregard medical advice, or discontinue medical treatment because of the information on our website or that which has been broadcasted by us.
Welcome, friends, to Inside Health. My name is Elham Fakhri, the presenter for the show. And today we're going to discuss health-related issues once again. Prior to start, I'd like to mention that we do have a surprise guest today. And we'll discuss a little bit about the world of neuroscience and psychology with him shortly. But as usual, before we introduce him and bring him into the show, I'd like to discuss a little bit about what has been out there in the news in the health world. Now, I have been talking about cancer previously quite a lot, but cancer is a big topic all over the world, and a lot of people are trying to find different ways to target different cancers. However, there has been some recent advancements in this area in terms of using the body's own immune system to defeat these cancerous tumors. Now, your immune system is your body's internal guardian and protector, as it purges anything that is not you. It has a series of checks and breaks in the system that prevent the immune system turning on healthy tissue. But cancer is a corrupted version of healthy tissue and can masquerade as normal to dodge our immune system. It performs the chemical equivalent of shouting, moving along, nothing to see here. So it really does dodge. The immune system cannot attack the cancer cells because it does not recognize it as a healthy tissue. It does this by producing proteins on its surface that perform a chemical handshake with the immune system cells to switch them off. Now, the immunotherapy drugs that have been developed, these are that have got people excited, are like an oven mitt that covers one of the hands, preventing that handshake that I discussed previously. The field has been developing for some time, but the explosion of front page newspaper headlines was triggered by data presented at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, ASCO, abbreviated. And now UK-led research showed that 60% of advanced melanoma skin cancer shrunk when two immunotherapies were given in combination. The dual treatment stopped some of these deadliest cancers progressing for nearly a year. And there has been some significant advance in the field of immunotherapy. As I mentioned, the ASCO announcement came 2 days after another immunotherapy trial showed that some lung cancer patients had their life expectancy doubled by immunotherapy drugs. Small trials in a wide range of other cancers have also been presented suggesting immunotherapy will have a role in many tumor types. Now, this is, as I mentioned, a very exciting area, as you could use your body's own defense system to target cancer. And our body is created in such an amazing way that it can function in a variety of different ways and protect you from infections and a variety of sort of inflammatory situations within your body. So using your own body's immune system and targeting cancer cells by use of immunotherapy drugs is really the new sort of weapon against cancer. The melanoma trial that I speak, it used a combination of two drugs, ipilimumab and nivolumab. Ipilimumab is already commended as a primary treatment for advanced melanoma in the UK. And so what they're seeing at the moment is a series of advances in the field with combination of two drugs to see even better results. Now, that was something interesting that I read on BBC News that I thought that I'd share with listeners. And the second issue is in revolving around mental health. This has been talked about a little bit recently on the news, as there has been some failing in the mental health trust and how things are run. There was a person who actually died, committed suicide as a result of his symptoms not being recognized early on by the doctors. And when he was referred to a specialist, it was done 1 month after he originally came to discuss this issue with his clinicians. I'll discuss this a little bit more detail with our guest, and also discuss a little bit more about neuroscience and psychology in detail. But prior to going into that, let's have a little break and listen to a lovely song by Aloha Surur that was presented on the BBC on New Year. So here's Aloha Surur on Afghan Voice.
چندی زمان دلم تنگ است، امروز به بهانه دلم تنگ است، چشمت قرار بود به جوشت باز بازه شراب خانه دلم تنگ است.
Welcome back, guys, to Inside Health. Now, as I mentioned previously, the second medical news that we'll discuss a little bit more in detail as it is related to this topic of neuroscience and psychology and a little bit of mental health. It was in regards to Matthew Denham from Norwich, who was 25 when he took his own life after his treatment was delayed. He told a mental health expert he had suicidal thoughts but faced a month-long wait to see a specialist at Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Trust. The care he received was criticized by a coroner 2 years on. His mother, Donna, is still haunted by the way he died. And this is a bit of a shocking news because somebody who comes to a hospital or to a mental health specialist and says that he has issues and suicidal thoughts, there should be something done about it quite quickly rather than having him that treatment delayed for such a long time. Now, although they're tackling this problem at Norfolk and Suffolk Foundation Trust, the reason why I want to discuss this specifically is because this is happening on a national level in countries such as Afghanistan. People have mental health issues and nobody is there to firstly recognize it and secondly be able to provide some sort of treatment. So that's the general theme for today, and we have a lovely guest who's a UCL student studying neuroscience in UCL, and his name is Elham. It's not me, it's another Elham Fateh. So firstly, I'd like to now welcome you, Elham John, to come to our show and discuss a little bit about yourself and talk about neuroscience and share your thoughts on this particular topic and also on a few other topics that we'll discuss. So could you just briefly tell our listeners about what you're studying and who you are?
Thank you for your lovely introduction. So I am, as you said, a student at UCL. I'm studying a combination of psychology and language sciences with strong neuroscience bases. So as you mentioned, in regards to the topic we're discussing today, this issue of mental health, it's one that's still there. It's a big problem, despite the development of psychology in the last 50 to 70 years. You summed it up brilliantly, to be honest. It's just this kind of like emphasis they put on the actual physical illnesses, biological impairments, more than psychological effects or, you know, pain and that sort of stuff. So I couldn't agree more. So the way this our system is working, our NHS is still not prioritizing mental health as much as they should. If you look at the investment in dementia, for instance, which is such an important kind of mental illness nowadays, there's very, very little money being invested. So you summed it up brilliantly. We need to like keep going and try to pursue a more direct approach to like tackling these mental illnesses.
That's interesting that you mentioned dementia. I have been speaking to a lot of people, consultants who are trying to get more money in order to be able to get research funding for dementia and be able to tackle the problem prior to it actually reaching a stage where you can't do anything about it. So as you mentioned, it is something which is underlooked and people don't recognize in the early stage, so they overlook it and disregard it. Just in general, could you just briefly describe what kind of modules do you have in your course and what is your specific interest in that area?
So my courses or my modules that are involved in my course include mainly neuroscience and like general psychology, so for example, social psychology, clinical psychology, neuroscience in terms of language, so how the brain, the actual brain, is linked to the language and its production and its comprehension. I have statistical, you know, information and learning, which is so important in psychology and neuroscience, and you know, some aspects of linguistics, which I really want to like emphasize. Hence, that's why I decided to study this course at university. Language is often overlooked in terms of its relation to psychology and the brain, but its importance is you know, it's valuable, since what distinguishes us as humans compared to animals is we have this complex syntactic structure in our language, which is really unique and stuff. So that's what kind of like made me pursue this kind of like subject of language or topic of language. And in addition to that, my main kind of like area of of, I wouldn't say expertise, but my area of like pursuit in the future would be neuroscience in the field of language, of mental health, of Parkinson's disease, so that those physical illnesses, like mental illnesses. So yeah, pretty much that's what.
So that sounds really interesting. You briefly mentioned about social psychology. Could you just briefly describe that? Because I do understand that that's sort of becoming a big topic, especially with the younger generations now. Could you just discuss a little bit about what social psychology is?
Social psychology is the application of your understanding of psychology and the behavior of people, the behavioral patterns of people in relation to the society they belong to. So it's quite a large part of psychology, but it's one that's less biological than for instance neuroscience or even clinical psychology. Its importance is that it's almost linked to anthropology. It tries to like understand how human behavior is linked to the society one belongs to. So for instance, one topic which really interested me is there's been numerous researches, for instance, like research that has suggested that our brain is unconsciously racist, for instance. So we struggle to like match words with an idea that are not likely to be generally, you know, perceived or portrayed. So in this experiment, for instance, speed reaction time was measured, and participants that took a click whenever they saw a matching pair, and the researcher would say, okay, so match, for instance, the color black to good, and then the next condition would be match the color black to bad, and people were struggled much more to associate black with good than black with bad. So that's social psychology. Mm-hmm. How like the media, for instance, like, you know, portrayal of certain races, certain aspects of life, are created by this external kind of thing, and then how is that linked to our understanding of behavior?
That's really interesting, and I think that sort of also touches hintly on what happened to you for Honda a little while ago. It's a bit of social psychology as well, isn't it? People were telling the attackers that if you're a good believer, you should attack this person because she burnt a piece of Quran. So that is a bit of social psychology as well. Would you agree? Or
well, you can say there's a link, definitely, because in my opinion, for instance, what happened in Afghanistan during that time was a shocking event, and what they tried to do in that aspect is, you know, try to blame her for something, you know, she didn't do, like as many claim. So the aspect of social psychology in that is how society reacted to a claim being made with very little evidence, and as a result, such a like abrupt, you know, response and such a violent response led up to that. So it just kind of shows how many people conform. So that's an important study by Milgram, one of the main you know, studies in psychology and you know, founding of psychology to some extent, some people claim, controversially though. He kind of argued that we have this kind of conformist behavior, this behavior to replicate other people's behaviors just to fit in. And you could argue that what happened to Farhonda at that time, with many people getting involved, probably many not knowing what happened, they're just conforming to the behavior of other people. So yeah, definitely right, there is this aspect of social psychology in this kind of like repercussions being made and violent behavior being displayed.
So that sounds really interesting. It's like following the crowd kind of saying, basically, a lot of people say, so you just do what everybody else is doing. And that is something that you do see in the current generation as well, in terms of fashion, in terms of so many other aspects. If you're different from somebody else, then you're sort of discriminated against it to some level. And if you're similar, then everybody tries to fit in and try to follow somebody else just so they could be part of a bigger society. So that's very interesting that you mentioned that. From your course, what's the most enjoyable aspect that you enjoy? I know you mentioned a bit about linguistics and neuroscience, the link between those two, but what is sort of your main passion within your field?
Well, this is going to be disagreed with many psychology students. They will say, why is he interested in that? But my main area of interest is actually statistics and maths. That's generally the worst or most boring part of psychology, according to many. But the reason why I really like it is I seem to really understand it. I seem to have that understanding, and this summer I'm taking part in an internship relating to that. So it's just really my my area where, you know, I feel the most comfortable, where I feel like I can display my abilities the most. But in addition to that, of course, an area of neuroscience, which I'm hopefully pursuing after my degree next year, is, you know, is also one of my favorite areas of psychology and neuroscience, you know, mm-hmm. of mental health, should I say.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, in terms of mental health, what is that attracts you to mental health? Why are you so interested within mental health and neuroscience in general?
That's a really good question. What happened with me and mental health is just it's so overlooked, and I tend to have this kind of like tendency to try to investigate why people dislike a certain thing or why people not pursue this certain thing. So that's what made me research it when I was in secondary school. So when I was in secondary school, I just thought about it, and I thought, you know, we all have this perception of psychology, or, you know, that kind of hypnotism, and mm-hmm. you know, of course it's not that, but like I started researching it and trying to understand why it's not taken seriously and how psychological, you know, dysfunctions are strongly linked to actual like brain behavior, like damages and brain behaviors and that sort of stuff. So that's what kind of made me like research it, and then I excelled when I was an A-level student. Mm-hmm. And my teacher forced me to do psychology. He said, no, there's no way you're not doing that. And you know, obviously a great place like UCL. So, you know, that's pretty much generally why I'm doing it.
All right, that sounds great. Thank you, Naz, for briefly discussing us about your course and what you're doing. Not briefly, actually, that was in quite detail. So thank you for the detailed information. And now next, I'd like to discuss a little bit about a few other matters in terms of the current generation, the young generation. And I have been discussing in the shows in the past about depression, about mental health. But one thing that I want to focus on today is that what should a young person do in terms of their mental health to be sort of healthy, have a healthy mental health, if that makes sense. Because a lot of the time nowadays, people are very overstressed with work or with studies. So what would you think is the best way to sort of alleviate that and sort of balance their life?
No, that's a really good question. Once again, definitely to deal or tackle these problems, there are several steps to be taken, in my opinion. One include this, you know, this kind of like social kind of like immersion. Personally, for instance, whenever I am stressed from university or work, because I work at the hospital as well, I try to like engage in social activities or sports or music, and that sort of stuff helps me relax. And many people could do that as well. You kind of find identity elsewhere. You take your mind to somewhere else. In addition to that, just, you know, communication is really important with friends, with family. Not stay by yourself. Express and you know, discuss whatever is on one's mind. And all these things are really key. This kind of like going beyond your personal kind of like space and trying to like interact with many people and stuff. So yeah, it's really hard to find one factor or like mm-hmm. one kind of like thing to do deal with that. There's no such thing, and that's linked to once again neuroscience. There's no such thing with one-to-one mapping in psychology and neuroscience. And in relation to what you said, our young generation have to look at you know, alternative situations to kind of deal with their stress, or especially with work, like you said, or with exams. Just, you know, engage in social activity, eat healthily. Of course, you should know, you know, how it works as a biomed graduate, and you know, all that sort of stuff all linked together.
That's really good. So what do you, you just briefly mentioned about your work in the hospital. Could you describe what you do in the hospital for us, please?
So I'm a ward at King's College Hospital, at the stroke unit, Friends Stroke Unit. So what I do is I work with mental health patients part-time, in addition to my studies, for over a year now, which is quite a lot. So what I do is I give them support post-stroke. So the majority of patients, or all patients over there, have experienced a stroke during a certain activity, you know. So the way strokes work is you don't have enough oxygen in a certain part of your brain that requires that activity. And what happens is obviously you experience a stroke. And so you have dysfunctions in language and in in language and motor controls and that sort of stuff. So what I do is I try to like contribute, give an extra hand to the medical team, as I'm not, of course, you know, a qualified mental health assistant yet, but I can give my experience or my knowledge of what I've learned at UCL, and you know, and try to give an extra hand and try to like help them out to speak, give a conversation. Many people also are worried to talk to nurses about the issues, and they would tell me, for instance, because they would feel I'm more, you know, I don't have that kind of medical expertise as much as they have. I'm more, I can touch them more on the human side, if that makes sense. So I just talk to them about it and try to contribute to language so their language develops and stuff.
I also believe that you're a little bit of a, you have your own ways of tackling with stress. Could you just tell us about what you do on extracurricular sort of activities to balance your study life, your work life, in general, just to avoid being overstressed?
No, definitely. No, as you said, it's hard with nowadays, you know, loads of pressure and loads of like commitments to be made. So what I do myself is that I'm involved in music and I'm involved in sports as well. So I'm part of a band at the moment, made from UCL students. We perform Afghan songs and I play the guitar, and that really helps. I you know, it just helps me relax, helps me connect with people differently. And that really helps me, to be honest. Like, there are days at university where it gets really hard and we tackle such difficult aspects of cognition, and you know, to be able to like kind of like let that go through music is amazing, especially Afghan music. So that's what we do at the moment.
All right, well, staying on that note, we'll take a little break and listen one of Naz and his band's called Shashunim's little songs, and be back right after that song.
Oh,
Welcome back, guys, to Insight Health with our special guest from UCL studying neuroscience today. We have been discussing a little bit about mental health, discussing a little bit about social psychology and neuroscience in general, and we'll continue talking a little bit more about that and referencing it back to, firstly, how psychology and mental health is seen in Afghanistan, and secondly, also discuss a little bit how it has developed from its early stages. There has been times where psychological matters or mental health has been seen disregarded quite heavily, and especially in Afghanistan and rural areas, it's been thought that it's a sort of a jinn attack, or not particularly in any way a medical issue. However, that has been evolving quite a bit, and I'll just like to discuss with our guest today about that evolvement, that how has it progressed from a stage where people thought that this is the mental health is sort of a complete non-medical issue, to a current situation where a lot of people do regard it as a medical concept and treat it as a medical issue and try to treat it in such a way instead of doing sort of different kind of rituals to cure a person. So what are your thoughts on the evolvement of psychology in the current medical world?
I personally think, to be honest, what you just mentioned is strongly linked to the development of science as a whole. Science has developed, has become more and more scientific and more accurate. And so the more accurate science becomes, the more people like start overlooking the role of religion, the role of rituals and stuff. So as time has progressed, like people have started to like see science, including psychology or mental health science, as the key to explaining behavior, for instance. So as a result, as you mentioned, psychology, for instance, has evolved to to a stage where people actually consider that mental illnesses are actual genuine and they're not linked to religion, and that's really interesting now, because we can link this strongly to like countries like third world countries like Afghanistan, or where that kind of scientific progression isn't as evident, and where you don't have that kind of like strong understanding and strong emphasis being put on like mental health to explain certain views.
Yeah, completely agree. I had a show a couple of weeks back in regards to mental health and how some people are treated in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. They're literally changed into a certain area, and they're not fed properly. They're just given some black pepper and some water, and that says that it cures them, but all that technically does to them is deprives them of nutrition. Mm-hmm. And any sort of person, any human being, a result of being deprived from food and nutrition would calm down, obviously, and wouldn't act as crazy. So they think that it's a treatment, but it's not actually a treatment. It's just a side effect of not feeding a person for that long period of time. So it's amazing how different societies and different countries treat psychological matters. Now, just looking back to the society that we have here, the older generation of Afghans, who have seen quite a lot of traumatic issues. What's your opinions in terms of how that side of things could be dealt with?
I mean, that's a really complex issue. Personally, there's no specific explanation for why psychology isn't considered very important in Afghanistan. But the way I look at it is this, it's very important to introduce that more and more. I think it's slowly starting to introduce in Afghanistan, very, very slowly. But hopefully we get to a point where people actually talk about their problems. Mm-hmm. The elder generation have experienced war, have experienced, many moments of sadness. And sometimes, talking about that helps. Mm-hmm. But I think many people are worried about opening themselves too much. They kind of want to keep everything to themselves. They don't want to, create any, stress. Mm-hmm. They don't want people to talk about them. It's all linked to to how we strongly have beliefs as Afghans. You know, we want to like be in control of our actions, and we don't want to admit. So, I mean, to some extent, it's also an issue of stigmatization. You know, nobody wants to like be seen as, oh, this person is mentally ill, and that's a really hard thing to take. Imagine in Britain, for instance, which has evolved so much, for instance, since the first, second World War, how difficult it is here to like stigmatize someone as mentally ill, you know, mm-hmm. to say to someone, oh, this person has schizophrenia, this person has, you know, this illness is very difficult to do. So in Afghanistan, it'd be much, much more difficult, mm-hmm. and people don't want to be seen in that light, you know.
Mm-hmm. I completely understand. And as you mentioned, it is a topic that a lot of people avoid. And with depression, the best way to sort of get rid of your depression is through talking. And a lot of the generation, as you said, it's a matter of pride. They feel that they'll be sort of weak if they talk to another person about what they have been through. And that's really important for, especially because the older generation now, depression is like, if you're Afghan, you're already depressed.
Yeah, yeah.
The chances of it are quite high, just because of the circumstances that especially the older generation and some of the young generation as well, who have lived in those conditions, it does affect your mental health.
But it goes beyond that in the sense where I personally think, for instance, where many people are scared to admit that they have a mental problem because, for instance, a man who has a daughter will not admit that openly because nobody would want to marry their daughter, for instance. They would say, oh yeah, this father is ill, mentally ill, we don't want to marry his daughter. You know, it goes beyond that. It has important implications to family and stuff. So many people are scared to like kind of like open that, you know, open their hands and out mm-hmm. their arms and admit openly, you know, that there's something wrong, because it has such a strong repercussion on you know, on the society and how people are seen, you know. So it's very, very complex. It's very, yeah. very complex.
It is. What would your personal opinions be in terms of how we could tackle this issue in Afghanistan as well as in Britain? Because it's not just a problem in Afghanistan. As you said, it's a worldwide issue. A lot of people do tend to ignore these even the authorities. They don't see it as they are slowly starting to change their thoughts and opinions, obviously, but it is a very slow progress. So what would your thoughts be in terms of how we could change this around and make it more sort of become people make people more aware of these issues?
I mean, that's a great question. The way it would work is mainly through education and you know, trying to tackle poverty, because those are two, you know, factors that undeniably are involved in, you know, in this. And you know, the younger generation, for instance, of Afghans, since, you know, the war, have progressed now, and have progressed in the sense where they're more educated and they're more getting to know, you know, what science is and the importance of science within the society. And as long as you establish those rules over a few generations, we'll get to that time where, like, you know, where everyone can progress and try to, like, take this issue of mental health really seriously. But, you know, it's going to be a slow process. It's going to require loads of acknowledgement, and that's not easy to do in all cultures, you know, mm-hmm. and Afghan culture as well, you know, trying to acknowledge that weaknesses do exist. Even in here, Afghans, for instance, they are scared to admit that they have, for instance, a mental illness. Mm-hmm. So it's just a question of time and education and trying to, you know, get to a higher level financially yeah. and emotionally as well. So, yeah.
Yes, that sounds very, very right, and I do agree that education does play a major role in terms of how people can talk about these issues more openly. Just a little bit more, could you describe a little bit about your course in general and why and what sort of people come and attend a course such as like neuroscience, and why people are slowly starting to go into roles which are involved a lot more in psychology?
Well, the way it works with psychology or neuroscience or whatever kind of mental health or brain science you study is that it has such important implications in all aspects of life. So, for instance, you can do psychology and do a politics degree after. So you understand behavior, and then you try to apply, do an application, a sort of application to a higher political, mm-hmm. you know, field. psychology has a, you know, importance in many other fields, you know, so finance, for instance, how to deal with businesses and stuff, forensics, you know. So that what people like about psychology is it's a very general but very specific course at the same time. And it's hard to find courses like that. So what it teaches you is about human behavior, which applies in all fields.
Yeah.
But on top of that, you know, you know, you can apply that to other fields and stuff. So I think that's why this kind of like a good kind of audience really interested in my course, for instance.
Yeah. I really like how you said that it can be applied to literally any other field because it's human behavior and the way the human brains work, why a person does a certain thing. And a lot of sort of businesses do take that as an advantage. So they do study psychology so they could understand why a person buys something or why how do you make a person buy a specific product. And the same thing in politics. So they try to try to study psychology so they could understand how human as a whole work and sort of target their politics as a result of that. So that's really interesting.
For instance, like next year, I'm doing a module called conversational analysis. And so what you do is you analyze speech between politicians, and you know, if you have that understanding, you can apply that to any field, you know, in the future. For instance, if you're trying to pursue a different field, you know, in law, you can apply that. So that's what I mean about psychology is such like general but also specific because it is scientific. It requires a good understanding of biology, of genetics, of neurotransmitters and stuff. So it's very interesting how, you know, how general and specific it is at the same time.
It's considered as a social science, but there's a lot of science involved into it in terms of how different biological and chemicals which occur within your brains and how they work. So it is becoming sort of an emerging new area, which is involving as well as the human behavior and psychological sort of matters, as well as the biological matters of how the human brains work and different molecules and different chemicals involved in processing those information. Just a brief question just for my personal interest in terms of sleep. What is your opinion in terms of the importance of sleep for a person?
Well, obviously sleep. Oh, I can tell you in terms of psychology if that
yes,
helps.
Yes, that's what I was looking for.
So in terms of psychology, or as a student or as a worker, you know, sleep is key to memory. It's strongly linked to memory. So you have so many students prior to exams, they don't go to sleep. They study all night, trying to cram everything, for instance, and they wake up and everything is forgotten. You know, they don't sleep and then everything is forgotten by the morning. What psychology has proven over and over again is what sleep does is consolidate your memory. So what you do is when you sleep on certain information, you remember it better the next day. So of course, 8 hours sleep, you know, the general kind of consensus is key in psychology, and it's agreed amongst many psychologists as a key to, like, you know, memory and consolidation.
I also believe that you are a very good football player. Could you elaborate a little bit more on that and how that has helped you sort of balance your life as well? And we have discussed about your artistic side so far, but what is the element of exercising bring into your current life, and how does it help you?
I mean, as you asked me earlier, you know, there are several things that kind of contribute to you as a person feeling more comfortable and cope with like demands of stress, and you know, and one thing is, you know, these extracurricular activities such as music, as mentioned, and obviously sports like in the form of football. So yeah, as I was growing up, I played for Watford FC, Championship team, Premier League team actually now, and you know, and that was really good because it was really competitive and really, you know, it kind of made me raise my game, and that's why I studied hard to get to UCL, which as I'm sure you know, it's quite difficult to get into, and you know, it kind of improves you as a person in relation to like what your ambitions are or your teamwork, your ability, especially in psychology, for instance. Like whenever a diagnosis is made, they try to seek for inter-rate of reliability, and that's an agreement amongst clinicians over a person being diagnosed with a certain illness. So you know, to be able to accept other people's views and work with their flaws or like, you know, strengths, and manage that for me has come from, you know, sports and music, and that's where I think like my experience in football or sports or music even has helped me, you know, develop into a teamwork player, you know.
That sounds really good. Now, I do believe that you have a match later on today, so I won't take too much of your time. We'll take a little short break and we'll be back right away with our special guest, Ilham Fateh, and we'll be right back after this little short break. Hi guys, welcome back to our show today with Ilham Fateh. That's another Ilham, it's not me, as you guys probably are aware. And as I mentioned today, the topic of discussion was neuroscience, psychology, a little bit of mental health, and a bit general discussion about what makes a healthy person have a healthy brain. Ilham John, a few questions in regards to the current generation at the moment. What do you think makes a person have a healthy mental health? What are the key factors which have a role in regards to the young generation, the older generation, as well as some other countries? What would you think would be the best?
Now, the question you just asked me is one of the most difficult in psychology and neuroscience, but I'll try to answer it in the best possible way. what makes a good healthy brain or a good, you know, is very subjective. What if you talk about the physical substance of it, you know, developed kind of cortical structures are seen really healthy, you know, that kind of like high volume of certain areas like hippocampus, you know, your visual lobe being more defined, that perhaps would say, oh, you're more healthy. But culturally speaking, you know, it's what, you know, for instance, let's discuss schizophrenia, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two kind of like diagnosis systems that are used in the West. For schizophrenia, it's DSM and ICD. Those are the two manuals they use to diagnose if somebody has schizophrenia, and based on those they make a judgment, you know. And so one of these are, for instance, hallucinations, which is so classically, you know, linked to schizophrenia. And so, you know, if you see some of these symptoms, okay, this person has schizophrenia. But in India, for instance, you know, if you have hallucinations, it's seen positively, so you can't apply that diagnosis there. So does that mean their brain is less healthy because they have hallucinations? Or does this mean that the culture influences them to portray, like, you know, experience certain, like, you know, certain, you know, feelings, certain behaviors?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very, very complex topic. It's one, if you follow what society, what Western society tells you, is, you know, one that's based on a good diet, on a good mental stimulation,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of high level conceptualization every day, you know, working hard and that sort of stuff mentally, you know, that contributes to a good healthy brain. But obviously in other cultures, you know, certain kind of behaviors are, you know, they go totally against what we believe here. And
mm-hmm.
does that mean they're not healthy because they, you know, they work as fine? You know, it's very very complicated.
Yeah, as you said, I guess it's a very subjective question in terms of, okay, what we might see as a healthy might be a completely different context. And for instance, Afghanistan, their idea of a good mental health might be slightly different than that what our concept to who in the West might be. So I completely agree on that. Could you just once again just briefly say what's your which mental health do you have most knowledge about? Like, what's the topic of most interest to you personally within the field of neuroscience and mental health in general?
That's a slightly hard question because I have a few interests, you know, there and there. But like this year, for instance, I can tell you what I've, you know, really worked on is aphasia, you know, like speech disorders and that sort of mm-hmm. stuff. And obviously that has neuroscience basis because damage to certain parts of the brain leads to like this aphasia developing. And it's very, very interesting the way the brain works, because so Paul Broca in 1896, I think it was a famous French like a neurologist, and he studied a patient who had a brain damage. We experienced a brain damage. So what happened is the patient showed certain language symptoms, so he couldn't produce sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Certain sounds he would produce very very limited, very incoherent sounds. And based on that, after death, they, you know, opened up his brain and they saw there was a massive lesion to a certain part now called Broca's area,
mm-hmm.
based on him. And what was really interesting is for so long they'd claim, oh, Broca's area, damage to speech, that's it, that's where it is. But this other neurologist in France, for instance, found that damage to there does not lead to speech production. So that's where neuroscience comes in. You know, how can you claim there's no such thing as one-to-one mapping? So, you know, for example, in biology, a damage to, you know, this part of your body, or, you know, a bone breaking, that means the bone is broken and mm-hmm. you're going to have, you know, a dysfunction there. In psychology, you can have damage to key areas that are often thought to be linked to language or vision, but you can still have a intact visual system and or, you know, speech system. And that's what it's so, so interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very good good topic, very good interest that you have. Within the next couple of years, what would your ideal sort of career progression be? Where would you want to head to next after your graduation?
Well, that's real soon, so I need to start thinking of careers ahead. I'm probably going to do a master's in neuroscience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what I'm going to try to do. And either become a, you know, work in statistics and maths, and mm-hmm. try to work as part of a medical team to calculate, you know, for instance, my role would be to calculate how big a lesion is in the part of mm-hmm. the brain, and to, you know, code data and try to find which areas of the brain are affected and just report that to a medical specialist.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that sort of field, or perhaps even, you know, just research, perhaps, you know, mm-hmm. in neuroscience, which is like growing so much. And
yeah.
and just work on that and see what happens. But right now, it's a very, very hard question because it's so broad, as I said, yet so specific. So it's, you know, so many options.
In terms of the research within neuroscience, it has been developed quite a lot. Is there any particular sort of research article that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, the main ones in neuroscience. Neuroscience come from Paul Broca, like to some extent. Paul Broca and Wernicke, Karl Wernicke. Those are the two kind of key components of neuroscience and linguistics. And those two have kind of like made more, like, you know, neuroscience, contributed to neuroscience. And you know, so I can just go into details into how Wernicke and Broca work. So as I said, Broca's linked to Broca's area is linked to speech production. Wernicke's area is linked to speech comprehension. So like, that's what we used to think, you know, there's a one-to-one mapping. Damage there would lead to damage to Wernicke, would lead to damage in comprehension. Damage to Broca would lead to, you know, speech production deficits. However, that's not exactly correct. So you get, like, as I said, you get, you know, alternative kind of like symptoms. You also found that, like, Broca's area is involved in motor cortex and implications. So like articulatory movements, because that's where they thought it's that kind of complexion of neuroscience, you know, despite having some of the best, you know, researchers at UCL, you know, at Stanford and Yale, some of the best neurologists in the world, we still haven't got, like, you know, a key understanding of neuroscience, and we can't claim that there's a one-to-one mapping between brain area and certain behavioral symptoms, you know, and that's what's very, very interesting.
Just a couple of final questions, because I'm really interested in these topics. In terms of language production, now it is quite unique that we as humans are capable to communicate with each other through languages, but we have some unique people who can speak several languages. Now, how does that, in terms of, obviously if you practice to learn a few languages, but how would you describe that process to work in terms of psychology and neuroscience?
Well, human language is, you know, what distinguishes from animals. So, you know, we have this ability to learn languages to a very high level, despite songbirds being really, really complex in terms of syntactic structures. What I found is, like, there are certain languages that are related to each other. For instance, French and Spanish, Italian, they have that kind of like link, you know, and you can pick them up easily. Same with, you know, Persian and Kazakh, and, you know, that's they have that, you know, that link. And what happens is you have overlapping in the vocabulary. So what happens is, you know, if you know one of those languages, you're likely to know another one. For instance, I speak French, so I can understand Spanish really well based on that. So, you know, my understanding of French contributes to that. In terms of neuroscience, that happens due to neuroplasticity. So, you know, the more you kind of rehearse that, the more, you know, it becomes easier to pick that up. And it's very, very interesting because there's a famous article, you know, very famous article that says that up until 9 months, children are citizens of the world. That's what they call them. So they can pick up any language. But then as time progresses, they have, like, kind of boundaries and that kind of, you know. And so linking to neuroplasticity, the older you get, the harder it becomes to learn these, you know, have this ability to speak many languages. But, you know, it's possible due to, like, you know, consistent exposure to the language and repetition and a strong desire, of course, as always, you know, is key.
Well, I'd like to end our show there. We've run out of time, and I believe you have a match to get to soon. So thank you very much, Elham John, for coming to our show and contributing your thoughts and discussing about your degree, about your talents, as well as a few other things. Is there anything, any final words that you'd like to share with our listeners?
You know, just keep working hard and try to keep your brain active. That's very key to, like, you know, keeping the high level of intensity and high level of performance. And I want to thank you and, of course, Afghan Voice for inviting me. And thank you very much.
Thank you.